Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is special coverage of the weekend events in Charlottesville, Virginia. The political junkie will join us on Wednesday morning. Today, a discussion about what the violence in Charlottesville reveals about this country's stubborn inability to reckon with our legacy of slavery and racism. Some context here. Those neo-Nazi groups that showed up in Charlottesville planned their demonstrations after the city decided to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee. The rally was called Unite the Right, and it brought together white supremacists, including David Duke, from all parts of the country. That's why we're examining today where the legacy of slavery fits in here. And as our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you with some depth and consideration. This isn't a knee-jerk, off-the-top-of-your-head conversation. I want to hear what you have to say about this, but I really want to hear thoughtful, considered thoughts on it. So here's the question. Where do you believe that these Civil War-era monuments, the housing and the job discrimination for Americans of color, the unjust criminal justice system, fits into this legacy of slavery? What are you wrestling with on this? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. I'll give you some of those thoughts again that I'd like you to respond to. Where do you believe that these Civil War-era monuments, the job and housing discrimination for Americans of color, the criminal justice system that's inequitable, fits into this idea of the legacy of slavery and segregation? What are you wrestling with on this? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Our guest for the beginning of the conversation, Kalila Brown-Dean, is an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, and she joins us today from New Haven, Connecticut. Kalila, welcome back to the show. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Carrie.
Michael Fauntroy is with us. He's associate chair of political science at Howard University, and he's with us today from Washington. And Michael, I'm glad to have you on the show as well. Thanks so much for making time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Kalila, Bryan Stevenson calls the era of slavery and the violence against African Americans that followed for decades and decades racial terrorism. And as I thought about that yesterday, I wondered if we acknowledge that that's what it is, might we be less likely to romanticize this history around the Civil War and these monuments to that history?
Well, I really think it's about who is included in the we. So that there have been people of color, you know, and others who have long said there is a history there that we have to reckon with. And if you think about a few years ago when those innocent people were killed in Charleston, South Carolina, it sparked a national conversation with people saying, well, the Civil War wasn't even about history. The Confederate flag doesn't represent slavery. It was about states' rights. And here we are in 2017 having those same discussions. You have to call a thing a thing. This is about racial terrorism and white supremacy and our inability as a country to address that.
You know, Michael, as I think about what Kalila just said about that national conversation that followed Charleston, the problem seems to be that the national conversation only goes so far and it's held on kind of a superficial way. And then, as I think some people worried through the weekend, it ends and we go on to the next shiny thing. So how do we have insight and some stamina to have the kind of conversations that we need?
Well, your question speaks to some of the frustration that I have about a lot of this. We only really have these conversations when the dust is in the air and people can't really see clearly about what the issues really are. And another frustration I have here is we have this sort of, you know, conversation about race when actually this is really about racism. And calling it what it actually is, as Dr. Brown-Dean just indicated. But in terms of stamina, I think the stamina has to come through, you know, an acknowledgement of what's real and what isn't. You know, we have come to this political term called fake news. And for a lot of people, what is actually the history is seen by them as fake news. And so as you have people all across the country who deny what has really happened in American history and do so for their own intellectual comfort, I think we get to this significant sort of fundamental issue, and that is what's true, what isn't, and what do we have to do to get people to acknowledge our real, true American history and past?
You know, Michael, I want to make sure I understand what you said there. You said that for too many Americans, history is also fake news. And are you saying that because the history can be shameful, can be uncomfortable, can force us to take a look at our own American identity in a way that is going to be embarrassing? Is that why?
I think that has a lot to do with it, Carrie. You know, as you know, there are people who deny that the Holocaust existed. There are people who deny that American slavery was as bad as it really was. And those are some of the same people that are at the forefront of what we saw in Charlottesville over the weekend. There are people who do not believe the fundamental truths of American history. And those are the same people that have been sort of swept up in this siren song from the 2016 presidential election and now feel unburdened and free to go in and pursue their own racist ideological beliefs, make them plain, put them out in the open, and hope that they're able to bring about some great racial renaissance, as I heard David Duke speak about over the weekend.
Yeah, Kalila, do you think that's part of what's happening?
I think it is. I think there is this concern that if we call a thing and admit to what it is, and, you know, I've heard a lot of celebrities say, this isn't the American way, this isn't us. And you have groups across the board saying, yes, unfortunately, it is. And so we have to be willing to put aside ego and arrogance to say, why is it that people are experiencing this? And what can we do so that it doesn't take the death of another innocent bystander, the deaths of two brave law enforcement officials, for us to say enough is enough? We can disagree. We do not have the right to terrorize people just because of who they are in our country.
CG on Twitter says the only just place for Confederate monuments is in the new African American Museum. Otherwise, destroy them. Ivan says we can remember our history without glorifying it or hiding it. East Europe has parks of old Soviet monuments, history preserved with context. Now, I want to make sure everybody understands this is not just a conversation about the monuments themselves. I started there because that is what created or that is what rallied a number of white supremacists to Charlottesville on this weekend. But I'm also talking about the larger implications of these monuments and the people that gather and rally around them and what that says, as Michael and Kalila are saying, what that says about who we are as Americans, what that says about our identity. So I want you to think broader and wider on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 to Gary in Crystal. Hi, Gary.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Concerning monuments and this denial of slavery's impact, It starts at the beginning of the Civil War, and the whole cloud of states' rights comes up after the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1876, where Reconstruction was ended, and Northerners basically abdicated the writing of history to Southern historians who came up with the myth of the noble cause and states' rights. But if one examines two documents, the Articles of Secession for the state of South Carolina and the Articles of Secession of the state of Mississippi, it becomes perfectly clear that their secession was solely about the proposition to limit the expansion of slavery into the free territories. And with the end of Reconstruction, it brought on a reign of terror that continued in some ways to this date. There is a very pertinent book on the subject called Slavery by Another Name, where it talks about the system of incarceration of black people and their immediately leasing into private industries in conditions that were even worse than slavery. So until we really address this and the truth comes out, and the fact that when most of these monuments were erected, the black people in those communities, whether it's Richmond or New Orleans, they were basically disenfranchised and had nothing to say about how their tax dollars were spent on these monuments.
Gary, point well taken. And let me just add this. Michael, this is something I wasn't aware of, that many of these monuments that have become controversial were erected in the late 50s and the 60s. These are not monuments, obviously, that go way back to the very end of the Civil War. What does that tell us about this history?
Even the earliest monuments that we're talking about were erected in the 1920s, as is the case in Charlottesville. They are monuments to terror and to try to chill public discourse. Remember, in the immediate aftermath of World War One, and that's really when a lot of this began, the monument construction. In the immediate aftermath of World War One, you have people talking about freedom in a variety of ways all over the world, in the United States too. And that was scary for a number of Southern conservative whites who had held on to this Jim Crow and been able to sort of pull the country back closer to where it had been previously after Reconstruction, before Reconstruction, rather. And so what we have now is people who have come to understand that these monuments are nothing about trying to sort of pay honor to a segment of American history, but rather to serve as a reminder, a daily reminder. You drive down the street, you walk down the street, you ride a bike down the street, that this is who we are, this is what we're about, and we're not going to accept any challenges to that. And so you fast forward to what we saw this past weekend, where people around the country are beginning to say, no, these monuments are illegitimate and have no place in a forward-thinking and forward-moving society. And here you have what we saw over the weekend. And so it's my hope that people understand that these monuments are not and were not erected to celebrate some measure of nobility. They're just a way to sort of remind people that, you know, terrorism isn't that far away.
Call here from Tony in Brainerd. Hi, Tony. Thanks for waiting.
Hello.
Hi. What are you thinking about?
Well, my problem is the media, and I'm not going to say the fake news or anything because news is all news. The problem is how the media actually reports it. And yeah, I'm going to go maybe off tangent a little bit, but the issue I see is it's a white officer shot a black male. And I think a lot of it falls back to you guys, your responsibility. You should not be labeling a race. If everybody can just look beyond that and see a person for a person,
yeah,
that would help
a lot. Yeah, Tony, this is why I wanted to take your call, and I hear your thoughts in a way that I think apply to a society that we don't live in. Kalila, would you address what he's saying?
Right. So I think that in an ideal world, we wouldn't see race. Well, some people wouldn't. But when people say to me, when I look at you, I don't see your color, then you deny not only who I am, but you deny the reality of why we are our country, how this country was built. And, you know, sort of connecting Tony's comments to this broader discussion, removing a monument becomes a hollow prize and low-hanging fruit. If you do not address the legacy of what that represents. So the ways in which issues of race and racism and supremacy become ingrained in what institutions do and how they do them. So there's certainly a legacy of someone like Philando Castile being killed with impunity, really. Because people say, well, why is it that you see someone as a threat? How is it that you're less threatened by a group of 300 people with torches descending upon a public university than someone sitting alone in a car? And so we have to address that reality. We have to address the ways in which those notions of difference manifest as economic inequality, or people being able to live in particular places, or not having access to quality schools based on their zip code. That's the American legacy of these things being inextricably tied, and that will require a multi-pronged solution that goes beyond dialogue and conversation.
And Tony, before I go to Michael, I just want to say, Tony, that is why I phrased the question to listeners for you to think about it in this frame. where do you believe that these Civil War era monuments, as symbols, not as an end to themselves, the housing and the job discrimination, the unjust criminal justice system, fits into this legacy that we're talking about this morning? And what are you wrestling with? That's why I'm asking it that way. And Michael, would you say something on that?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's, you know, we can pick out individual events that tend to run counter to the trend. But the trend is really what we need to be focused on. And I think, to sort of broaden this out a little bit, if you think about Charlottesville in the context of Minnesota, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a range of other events that have occurred around the country, you know, I don't see the space for a responsible pushback. You know, an innocent woman was killed in Charlottesville in a counter protest against white supremacy. So for me, it's either you're for that or you aren't, and I'm going to stand with her. And I know there are a lot of people that are listening to us who will, and there'll be some who are on the other side. And so I just want all of the listeners to understand that they are real and pervasive problems here in this country that we aren't facing up to. And I really think that we need to be focused on that more so than some of these other things that may make sense when taken out of context, but not in the larger trend of things.
If you've just gotten into the conversation, you hear us talking about bigger ideas in the wake of the violence in Charlottesville over the weekend, and you hear Michael Fauntroy from Howard University and Kalila Brown Dean from Quinnipiac, and me asking you to give this some depth and some consideration. As I said at the beginning of the show, this isn't an off-the-top-of-your-head discussion. But I welcome hearing from you. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, Michelle says, in my opinion, intellectual discomfort is a key point. How do we teach people to sit with this discomfort so that they can look closely at the truth? And Beth says, I come back to, what can we do to fix these issues? How do you get people to believe truth? And how do we change institutional racism? And to the phones, did Daniel, listening in Iowa. Daniel, what are you thinking about?
Well, you know, I'm a blue-collar worker, and I worked all over the country, and I have come face-to-face with racism as a white man and other white men in their little clique, and sexism also, and it's in the shadows. They don't come out. It, but it's deep rooted and it's being taught to their children. My father retired out of Alaska for 35 years, moved to Nebraska. They were flying a Confederate flag at the post office, and he had a deep problem with that. He wrote the postmaster, talked to the governor, and they brought the flag down. It's been hanging there for 35 years in a small rural town. He had to deal with problems in the community about where he stood there. He was kind of ostracized for that. But he ended up getting put on the wall of tolerance somewhere. I got some letter. He's dead and passed on by now. And I think it's kind of like, you know, they want to say, they want Muslims to call out terrorist factions. Well, it's time for us as white men and women to stand up to these people in unity.
I appreciate the call. You brought to mind a question that I wanted to ask Kalila and Michael about that, which is, I wonder, Kalila, if this is about shame that prevents us from fully confronting this. I mean, is it the fact that we're not ashamed enough? Is it too much shame or not enough shame?
Well, I also think it's about what we expect that shame to do.
Okay.
So what some of us may see as being shame and unacceptable, others are sort of exalted for that, right? We like the fact that there are people who are not politically correct or not adopting these socialized norms about what's acceptable. And I think the point that Daniel raised is important here. It is not just when thousands of people siege an American city that we need to be outraged. They are those everyday, mundane, pedestrian ways in which issues of racism and anti-Semitism play out that we have to be accountable for. And we also have to reject the notion that this is a Southern problem or that it's unique to my home state of Virginia or to my alma mater, the University of Virginia. This is playing out in communities and in homes across our country. So we have to talk to people who look like us, who think like us, and who live where we do, instead of always expecting the other side, to use the president's language. And to be clear, there's only one side here. Only expecting others to shame us into doing what we know in our hearts to be the right thing.
I think this is a good moment to bring one of our other guests into the conversation because he's been listening to what you've just said, Kalilah. Mark Anthony Neal is with us. He's chair of the African and African American Studies Department at Duke and with us from Durham, North Carolina. Mark, hi. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning, folks.
Would you talk to me about what Kalilah just said? Because I think we have a tendency maybe in this part of the country where many African-Americans came escaping the kind of segregation in the South and the consequences of that. And so we feel like we're a bit removed from this. But I hear Kalilah saying, you can't afford to be removed. What would you say?
You know, I take the example, for instance, the young man who drove the car is, you know, from Kentucky and Ohio. I was driving through Ohio yesterday after dropping off my daughter in Chicago. I was more fearful driving through Ohio and West Virginia than I've ever been driving through North Carolina or South Carolina. That's just the reality of where race is. I think we, for a long time, have tried to scapegoat the American South as being the cauldron where this kind of racist activity occurs. You know, it's one of the reasons why Charlottesville resonates the way it did for us these last couple of days. But, you know, this is a national problem, right? Folks are dealing with these dynamics, whether or not we're talking about Minneapolis or the city of Boston. And we could just think about Henry Louis Gates's experiences with police officers, you know, almost a decade ago. You know, so I think Kalilah is dead on in talking about the fact that we need to broaden our conversation about what these realities look like for us. I think what is unique, of course, is in the South is where you're going to have these monuments, right? The South, if we think of that as kind of the attempt to be the last stand for a very public ideology of white supremacy, that particular reading of the South, I think, is very real.
What would you say, Michael?
I want to pick up on the word shame that you used. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons why there's been less activity, and this is sort of in line with what the caller was saying, among whites, isn't just that there isn't enough shame. It's just that for some, the feeling is if I'm shamed, then I'm automatically deputized in this fight against white supremacy, and I don't necessarily know that I want to be involved in all this. Mm-hmm. And I get that, but the reality for me is that all of us, wherever we live, anywhere in the country or in the world for that matter, need to understand the fundamental truths and lies about the history in which we find ourselves. And I will tell you, whether it's New Hampshire or Minneapolis, Minnesota or Colorado or Texas or Mississippi, these kinds of things can and do happen all the time. The kind of ideological sort of perversion that allows people to believe that one is better than the other just because is something that occurs everywhere. And as long as we have national leadership at some level that's prepared to tolerate and wink and, in fact, allow themselves to win office on the strength of those kinds of beliefs, we're going to continue to see them. And unless and until people stand up and say, no further, we're not going any further down the road with this.
Michael, you know I'm always grateful for the time and the insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Fauntroy with us from Howard. Kalilah, thank you very much. Really good to have your thoughts and your insight today.
Thanks, Carrie.
Kalilah Brown-Dean with us from Quinnipiac. And Mark Anthony Neal continues with us today from Duke. And Mark, a call for you from Liz in Minneapolis. Hi, Liz. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, thanks. Say, I just have two observations, sort of. I lived in Charlottesville for the last 8 years, and mm-hmm. I just moved home to Minneapolis about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this was shocking that this happened. My observation is that, you know, when I was there, I worked for nonprofits, and I'm in fund development. And the conversations about cultural humility and microaggressions and cultural competence, those conversations are happening, and people are working really hard to understand and address the various issues of race that are within the culture and within institutions. And, you know, Charlottesville is really liberal. We had elected a Muslim mayor. And what's sort of interesting to me about this all is that when I moved 8 years ago, the conversations about cultural humility were sort of just beginning. And I had come from Minneapolis where those conversations had taken place, and we were already, you know, working to build cultural competency, which was called at the time, into our systems and into the, at least in the early childhood development field where I worked. So it was interesting to me that the conversations had seemed to just start to take place. And then juxtaposed to that, the other observation I have is that, so first, I think the city and people are working really, really hard to address issues of culture, and the idea to take down the statues is a part of that. On the other side, juxtaposed to that is Charlottesville itself has over 40% poverty in the city, and there's an enormous amount of wealth in high capacity within the city itself and in the foothills, and that always seemed to be just such a stark, you know, difference between, you know, the struggle that's going on to address culture, but also the vast gap,
right,
that truly does exist there. And they call it sort of the velvet rut in a way.
And Liz, this is exactly why I didn't want the discussion today to begin and end with this monument. What you've just said is exactly the reason, and I think the frustration that conversations start, I hate this phrase, national conversation, but they do to some degree start, and then they kind of end at a fairly superficial level. Although I do hear you saying that in Charlottesville, they were doing some of the harder work on this. Liz, are you there?
It's happening, and we were having the conversations. It was, at various levels of institutions and nonprofits in the city. I think really the work is being done, and I think it is a conversation that's ongoing, and it's out there. I mean, it's happening, which is shocking that this would happen this weekend. Given the hard work, I think that's happening in the true, you know, spirit of wanting to kind of overcome this past that Charlottesville has.
Mark, Liz, thank you so much for calling. I'm really glad you waited. Mark, what do you hear in what she's saying?
I think it's a realization, again, when we're talking about Charlottesville, we're essentially talking about the University of Virginia. We could be having the same conversation about Durham, North Carolina, and Duke University, or Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and the University of North Carolina. College and university spaces tend to be, in comparison to the, you know, municipality that they're in, a little bit more liberal. We have these we have these conversations on these campuses because, in fact, there are curriculum set up at the universities that allow us to have these discussions. I think where we see a kind of disconnect, and I'll use white supremacy as a good example of this, you know, black political thought, for instance, is founded on a critique of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. Black studies, by and large, has always had an embedded critique of white supremacy. There are folks who watch what played out in terms of Charlottesville this last weekend that don't have a fundamental understanding of what white supremacy is. And I put that onus in terms of mainstream media to do the kind of work where it's not just trying to get pundits on both sides to argue about the events, but to provide some sort of historical context about what exactly is happening here. And again, this is in the context of which, and we could talk about this in the context of the administration, but also other places in the culture, and which has consistently demonized the so-called liberal education, the liberal arts education. So even when there is a body of thought that's produced around thinking much more egalitarian around these kinds of issues, that kind of thought is demonized, right? Those 100 to 200 people with torches absolutely despise the fact that there might be a women's studies department or a black studies department or an Asian American studies department at the University of Virginia. And again, when you have an administration that has been very critical of so-called liberal media. And however you might feel about the New York Times, from my vantage point, the New York Times has never been all that liberal. But in the context of these conversations, right, the kind of spaces where we've had discourses that have allowed us to think more progressively around these issues, they are being actively demonized at this particular point in time.
We're going to get a look at the latest news. We're going to continue our conversation and pick up on what Mark Anthony Neal has said. And I want you to know, we have not specifically talked about the president's reaction to this yet, because I didn't want this show to become all about let's just fire at Trump with our anger. We're going to discuss about the politics and what the president's statement means and doesn't mean, or the lack of the statement on this. But I still want you to think deeply about what Mark just said and about what Michael and Kalila have said and what our next guests are going to say. What are the monuments, the housing and the job discrimination for Americans of color, the criminal justice system, which we've had so many discussions about on this show? How does it fit into this legacy of slavery and segregation? And you just heard Mark saying he in some ways comes back and says to the media, why not contextual discussions on this? And that's part of what we're trying to have. I'm going to go back to him and ask him for more thoughts on that as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Back in a minute on the other side of news to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Kerry. Pressure is mounting from both political parties for President Trump to explicitly condemn white supremacists and hate groups. Trump initially responded to the deadly race-fueled clashes Saturday in Virginia by blaming bigotry on many sides. Attorney General Jeff Sessions today said the president condemns and opposes racial violence. Meanwhile, bail has been denied the Ohio man accused of ramming his car into the protesters in Charlottesville. The chief executive of the nation's third largest pharmaceutical company is resigning from the president's American Manufacturing Council, citing a responsibility to take a stand against intolerance and extremism. President Trump lashed out at Merck CEO Kenneth Frazier on Twitter, saying Frazier will have more time to lower rip-off drug prices. The top U.S. military officer says the U.S. wants to peacefully resolve a deepening standoff with North Korea, but is ready to use the full range of its military capabilities. The comments by Marine Corps General Joseph Dunford appear to be an attempt to ease anxiety over threats between President Trump and North Korea, while also showing a willingness to back up Trump's warnings if need be. France's foreign ministry says a French national was among those killed in the attack by suspected Islamic extremists on an upscale Turkish restaurant in the capital of Burkina Faso. The BBC reports gunmen on motorbikes opened fire on patrons at the restaurant, and it says security forces killed the gunmen after several hours. And authorities in Sierra Leone say at least 21 people are dead amid heavy flooding. Storms swept through the capital of Freetown early today, flooding downtown streets and creating mudslides in hilly areas. Sierra Leone's national television broadcaster interrupted regular programming to show scenes of people digging through mud to retrieve the dead bodies of loved ones. The casualty rate is to go much higher, expected to go much higher. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
On All Things Considered, the news from the people who make it.
They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
I'm Tom Cran. The big stories of the day and what to expect tomorrow. Join me weekdays starting at 3.
I'm Tom Weber. Stay with NPR News all morning for more coverage of the aftermath of this weekend's violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, including next hour on 1A, and at 11 o'clock, hear from some Minnesota voices as well. Continuing coverage all day as well at nprnews.org.
This is also a moment for me to tell you about a show, a national call-in show on American identity that I'll be hosting. It's called Flyover. We start on September 10th. That's a Sunday. We'll be at 3 o'clock Central Time nationwide as we examine who we are as Americans. Name of it is Flyover, hashtag Flyover Radio, and I'll see you there.
Programming supported by Minnesota West Community and Technical College, offering over 60 majors and 20 online options leading to job opportunities. Information at mnwest.edu.
Back to our conversation now about the violence in Charlottesville and what it reveals about our stubborn inability to reckon with the legacy of discrimination and slavery and racism in this country. Bringing some new guests into the conversation now. Jennifer Rubin is with us. She writes the Right Turn blog for The Washington Post and with us from Fairfax, Virginia. And Jennifer, welcome to the show. It's good to talk to you.
It's very nice to be here.
And Andra Gillespie is with us. She's an associate professor at Emory University's Department of Political Science, and she's with us from Atlanta, Georgia. And Andra, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Jennifer, I want to come to something because we left off at a moment that's a good time to talk about something you wrote in the Post this weekend. You said about these statues and the monuments and the legacy that flows from them, we've now erased the fictions that these monuments are about Southern heritage. No, they are giant concrete shrines to white nationalism. Will you add some context around that?
Sure. And I do agree with one of your other guests who said that there is not enough context about this. These were created by and large during or erected during one of two times. One during the Jim Crow period, when Southern states were passing one law after another to segregate, to prevent interracial marriage, to prevent all sorts of, put up all sorts of barriers so that African Americans could not participate fully in society. And this was one of the prime ways in which they sort of made an exclamation point on what was going on. So they erected these enormous statues with basically the reminder that, yes, we may have technically lost the war, but these are our heroes. This is who still commands our respect and attention. The other period of time was in the 1950s and 60s, and that's where many of the flags went up. We've had the flag battles as well, and that was, of course, as the beginnings of desegregation were coming. So these are not so much historical markers. They're not on battlefields. They're not commemorating any particular event, but rather they are, as I wrote, shrines to the so-called lost cause, which is itself a myth, and the notion that there was some grand antebellum society that they were preserving is nonsense. This was racism. They fought to enslave Americans. They killed hundreds of thousands of Americans. And the notion that we should celebrate these statues and that people should feel they were being deprived of something when they come down is, when you take a step back in historical perspective, mind-boggling, really.
You know, Andra, at the beginning of the conversation, we talked about whether if we stripped away the romanticism and we called this around the South and the antebellum era, and we called what happened then and what has happened in the decades since racial terrorism, and then I hear Jennifer calling this white nationalism, would we get more to a more candid conversation about this, the kind that Mark was saying before the break that we need to have, that it needs to be deeper and contextual?
Well, I mean, I think that that gets us part of the way, and I certainly applaud Jennifer for what she said in her op-ed piece. I think the thing that's more important, I think, goes back to what Mark said earlier. There are a lot of people who are woefully ignorant about American history. The fact that in 2017 today, you can still have people who will argue with you about the cause of the Civil War and slavery's role in fomenting the Civil War is a sad state of affairs. And the fact that there are many people who are walking around blissfully ignorant of the history of not just African Americans, but other racial minorities in the United States is also something that's problematic. And that's part of the reason why hatred and bigotry are allowed to foment. And it's also one of the reasons why it is so vitally important for us to make sure that people get a full balanced view of history and to understand that we do that as a project of love of America, not as a means to criticize America. That critique is done to make it better, not necessarily to perpetually keep us down.
You know, Mark, I think Andra has hit on something there, too. I think maybe the understanding of this stops at a place where people can, for whatever reason, cannot tolerate this kind of criticism of their country. Why?
I mean, first of all, it opens wounds. It makes people feel a certain level of guilt. You know, Andrew and I are both in the classroom, and I'm sure she, like me, has had those occasions where you reveal things to your students, and they're absolutely shocked because they've never heard it before. No one's ever told them that before. They've never heard some of these narratives about what American history really is, you know, in a K-12 classroom. You know, that being said, we also need to be honest about the fact that even as these narratives might now be pushed into the mainstream, there are a fair amount of white folks who are actually invested in the idea of white supremacy and white nationalism. Again, that was one of the strategies that I think the White House used very successfully over the last 8 months to find this so-called group of folks who are on the underground. They come up into the mainstream and become mainstream spokespersons for, you know, in one way, it's easy to describe it as a white hate group. But when we talk about it as a kind of fundamental ideology of the United States, right, that's when it's a very different kind of conversation. And I think we need to be honest about what white supremacy means in this country at this point in time. I think we need to be honest about the anger that we're starting to see amongst white men between the ages of 30 and 50 and 60 years old. Part of that is about a fundamental shift in terms of what labor looks like in the United States. The fact that the president can talk about rebuilding coal mines that, for all intents and purposes, had no real future 30 years ago is about appeasing a population and not being honest about where their futures are. And it's so much easier to talk about the threats of black folks and immigration and Muslim terrorists than to actually own up to the fact that we have a fundamental crisis in this country about the future of labor and, in particular, the future of masculinity, both black and white.
You know, Mark, I just have to ask you, because what you've said is so compelling. And then before the news break, you said, and I point this back at the media for not leading these kinds of conversations. What? Tell me what's missing out of this, and as a member of the media, that I can contribute to doing better.
Well, let me be honest, right? If we're talking public radio, right, that tends to be a very different conversation. But if I'm looking at some of the mainstream corporate news media, it's all about the battles of punditry, right? You get somebody on your side, and then you get somebody on your side, and let's have an argument. Literally, let's spar on air without coming to any resolution. Literally, right, in terms of one of the best educated, in terms of the best scholars in the country, in the world, being here in this country, very rarely is that expertise utilized to put some context to what exactly is going on in the country right now.
What do you think of that, Jennifer?
I agree with every word. I do think that the failure to impart any sense of perspective of historical accuracy was something that Donald Trump exploited to perfection. He built a campaign around white resentment, convincing folks that something was taken from them by people of color, whether they resided in China and were exporting goods to the United States, whether they were coming to live here to make a better life for their family. This was an explicit appeal to a sense of aggrievement, so that there is a segment of our population who believe, and there's been some really stunning polling done, they really do believe that whites are the most discriminated against, the most aggrieved segment of our society. And that is a tremendous failure, not only of the media and our education, but of other politicians as well. And the real silence on the right and the unwillingness of many to engage in that argument and to say, no, your problems are not related to immigrants. Your problems are not related to the way colleges maintain a balance and diversity. The conversation is not joined, and that's the failing of politicians, it's the failing of our education system, it's the failing of really public officials. And I would raise this proposal, because we've sort of left corporate America out of this, and I don't think we should. Mm-hmm. Today, as your newscast recalled, the head of Merck who resigned from Donald Trump's Manufacturing Council. This is one of these little props that he puts together of business executives, and they all sit around the table and they nod and they take some pictures and they make him appear to be a normal president.
Uh-huh.
The head of Merck, who happens to be African-American, said, I'm resigning out of a sense of responsibility. I'm appalled by recent events, and I don't want to be part of this. Every single member of that council, white, black, Hispanic, whatever, should follow him out the door. Why are these people providing cover for the president as if this was a normal presidency? Every one of those corporations, we're talking about big corporations in America, have diversity policies, anti-discrimination rules. What is their public conduct like, and how do they contribute to the national dialogue? So I think it's up to everyone, not simply in the public sector and the media, but people in the private sector as well, to begin to articulate what their values are.
Call here from Obi in St. Paul. Hey, Obi, thank you so much for waiting. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So I'm a white pastor in the United Church of Christ, and I live in St. Paul, but I serve a mostly white church in the Morningside neighborhood in Edina.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like our calling now is to equip our community to keep facing racism, despite what a tendency towards white fragility, where white folks are tempted to shut down when we're asked to face racial realities. So yesterday I preached on finding ourselves at threshold moments like this after Charlottesville and trusting God for the courage to face what is shameful or frightening in white history and remembering that God is not a white man. I think about, I get some centering from what Adrienne Marie Brown tweeted a year ago or so. She's a Black Lives Matter activist who says, things are not getting worse, they're getting uncovered. We must hold each other tight and continue to pull back the veil.
So how does the congregation hear a message like that from you?
I received more feedback from folks than I normally do with my sermons. I got an email yesterday afternoon saying, wow, you've really made me rethink my image of God, rethink where we are called to be as a church at a time like this. I have heard back from people on various parts of the political spectrum in our congregation who said that this is a message they needed to hear. I'm grateful for that.
And I'm grateful for the call and that you were listening today. Thank you. Andra, to come back to the president, because there's a lot of focus on that. I didn't want that to be too much of a distraction to the discussion. But he's flying back to Washington today, and cable news is reporting that there's going to be, he's going to make more remarks. How much at this point does that matter?
Well, I think it matters depending on what President Trump intends to do going forward. One isolated incident. One, sort of, I'm going to take back what I said yesterday or clarify what I said, on Saturday isn't enough. I think what people are looking for is that turn. And so I'm going to use Christian language since you just had a pastor on your call. I think people are looking for confession and they're looking for repentance. I don't think we're holding our breath to see that, given the fact that, President Trump has tweeted out against Kenneth Frazier for, quitting
right.
the board. I don't expect that we're going to see this happen. But if President Trump is actually serious about bringing the country together, if he's serious about leading and demonstrating leadership, which means being willing to lose votes to stand up for what is right, then the first thing he's going to have to do is apologize for all of his incendiary rhetoric that helped to contribute to what we saw happen in Charlottesville. And then he's going to have to demonstrate for the rest of his term in office his sincere desire to make amends by cleaning up his White House staff, by changing his policies, by changing the rhetoric, and basically making a 180 from what he's done before. That's the sign that he is growing as a person and growing as a leader and moving forward, and that's going to put him into a position to help carry the country forward and to carry this project of racial reconciliation forward. And like I said, given how he's behaved just his entire political career and what he's just done within the last few minutes suggests that this is probably not going to happen. But the other thing that probably at the base minimum he needs to do is he needs to show pathos in part, you know, when he read his statement out on Saturday, it was almost like watching Alex Jones on InfoWars apologize for something he was about to get sued. And so it's done in kind of a very monotone fashion where it's like, I'm just saying this because I have to, not because I mean it. He's going to have to show some, like, you know, sort of visible signs of contrition. And then he's going to have to realize that the onus is on him to build people's trust and confidence.
And Jennifer, that's precisely why my expectations are low. And here's the other thing. If he doesn't truly believe it, if this isn't a conviction, then what does it matter?
Yes, I wouldn't hold our collective breaths either. And I think that's for two reasons. It's important to understand why he won't do this. One is, this is an explicit part of his message and his agenda. He can no more renounce this than he can declare himself to be a free trader and a proponent of increased immigration to America. This is what he ran on. This is who he is. So it would take a complete political and personal revelation, which he is not inclined to participate in, for this to reverse itself. And the other is, the president operates with one thing in mind and one thing in his mind only, and that is loyalty. He was more aggressive and angrier at Kenneth Frazier,
who the CEO of Merck,
than he was
right.
at the killers in Charlottesville, because one is loyal to him and one is not. That is his entire focus. So I think it's almost impossible to believe he's going to reverse course. But consider some of the things that other members in public life could demand. They could demand that people who are the so-called alt-right, which is a nice phrase, a fluff phrase for white supremacy and white nationalism, they could demand that finally get rid of people like Stephen Bannon and people like Sebastian Gorka. They could demand that the so-called fraud commission, which is really a voter repression commission, be shut down.
Yeah, we did a there show on that last week. Right.
Yeah. There are specific things that other people in public life can call for in addition to repeating the call for him to say something. It's almost as if they're giving him such a low bar, hoping he will hop over it so that they can then put this behind them and move on to something else. And that really should not be allowed to occur. I think there should be a specific agenda that we collectively as society have. And I think the president and his advisors and members of Congress should be held to account for that. And you can start with ridiculous measures like the proposal to cut immigration in half, which is really just another assault on an interracial society and is economically really mindless. So there are many things the president, the administration, Congress could be doing, but it really takes some will and some political voice to come to a consensus about what is and what is not acceptable in this society.
Jennifer, I thank you very much for the insight and the time. Mark, thank you so much. Good to have you on the show. And Andra, thank you. Really good to have you on the show.